first, it was Garland, Texas that held the Muhammad cartoon contest. Now it's the Valley's turn. A Phoenix man is organizing a free speech protest at a mosque, which members are concerned will send a dangerous message.
We have to counter hate with love, or the haters win.
I'm Steve Goldstein. Also today on the show, residents in Arcadia are fighting over whether a Frank Lloyd Wright-designed home should just be preserved or turned into something much more dramatic.
We don't think that we need to have a tourist destination in our neighborhood.
And this property, in my mind, will be what real estate professionals call a cultural amenity.
Plus, Phoenix has seen dramatic growth since World War II, but we'll ask the question, should the city even exist? How is the drought affecting long-term food supplies and secrets of Mesa's Falcon Field? That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein with Mark Brody. There's concern growing about a planned rally in Phoenix that'll include a cartoon drawing contest of the Prophet Muhammad. As KJZZ's Will Stone reports, the Islamic community is discouraging people from coming to the event, which will take place outside a prominent mosque during Friday prayers.
Organizers say it will be a peaceful, freedom of speech rally to expose the violence of Islam. At the same time, they're also encouraging bikers and others who come to, quote, utilize their Second Amendment right. That has many nervous about what could transpire outside the community center in Phoenix. Imran Siddiqui is president of the Council on American Islamic Relations Arizona chapter.
Firstly, this is not about a quote-unquote draw the prophet contest. Secondly, this is not about challenging radical Islam, as the protest leaders are now scrambling to say. It is explicitly stated on the Facebook page of this group that's protesting that they want to rid America of Islam.
Siddiqui says this protest comes on the heels of letters sent to several mosques in the valley that threaten to massacre worshipers. But John Ritzheimer, a former Marine and the one behind the protest, says this is about free speech and countering the, quote, death cult of Islam. He was motivated to organize the rally after the recent shootings in Garland, Texas, by two Muslim men who had attended the mosque in Phoenix.
We got militia groups coming out to play a neutral role. I'm not the only one that's in this country that sits on the couch and sees another thing happen on the news and saying, I wish somebody would do something. It's time for us to get together and take it to their doorstep.
Ritzheimer has held a similar event before. Over 1,000 people have RSVP'd yes on the Facebook event page for this rally. Dr. Yasir Sharif, who's with the Council on American Islamic Relations, says they're asking people to stay away from the rally and will be organizing their own interfaith gathering next week.
We have to counter hate with love, or the haters win. That's what Prophet Muhammad taught us, and you cannot draw that in a cartoon.
Police have been in contact with the mosque and event organizers and will have a presence at the rally. Will Stone, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
It's the show on KJZZ. With the takeaways, John Hockenberry. I'm Steve Goldstein. It's a moment of truth right now for the USA Patriot Act and determining just where President Obama stands on the issue of data collection from U.S. citizens by the NSA without their knowledge.
Determining where the president stands is challenging. Once upon a time, right after the Edward Snowden leaks, President Obama seemed appalled and was anxious to reform NSA practices.
I called for a thorough review of our surveillance operations before Mr. Snowden made these leaks. My preference, and I think the American people's preference, would have been for a lawful, orderly examination of these laws, a thoughtful, fact-based debate that would then lead us to a better place.
But it's clear that some in Congress believe that those better places depend on keeping surveillance of U.S. citizens in place. Congress is running out of time to save two sections of the Patriot Act, provisions that this week the president told the nation he now considers essential to protecting national security.
I said over a year ago that it was important for us to properly balance our needs for security with civil liberties. And this administration engaged on a bipartisan, bicameral basis, talking to Republicans and Democrats about how we could preserve necessary authorities but provide the public greater assurance that those authorities were not being abused.
The Senate will convene for a rare Sunday afternoon session to work on a deal before key provisions of the Patriot Act expire at midnight. The most notable provision is Section 215, used by the NSA to justify collecting bulk data. That's the program Edward Snowden made famous, and the program a federal appeals court deemed illegal earlier this month. And it's also the very same kind of intelligence gathering the president campaigned to end altogether in 2007.
I will provide our intelligence and law enforcement agencies with the tools they need to track and take out the terrorists without undermining our Constitution and our freedom. That means no more illegal wiretapping of American citizens. No more national security letters to spy on citizens who are not suspected of a crime. No more tracking citizens who do nothing more than protest a misguided war. No more ignoring the law when it is inconvenient. That is not who we are.
Well, many years later, the who and the we in this instance are a little unclear. And so joining us is David Sanger, national security correspondent for our partner, the New York Times. David, do we know where the president really stands on this Patriot Act issue? And does there remain any consensus close to what there was when the Patriot Act was quickly passed after the 9/11 attacks?
Well, you know, after the 9/11 attacks, there was no question that Congress would pass just about anything, John, that President Bush at that time would have asked for. And, of course, they renewed the Patriot Act some number of years ago, toward the end of the Bush administration, with very little debate and perhaps very little understanding on the part of members of Congress, other than those who belong to the intelligence committees and a few others, about how the act was actually being interpreted. So if you pick apart what the president said in those various clips, what's really fascinating about it is that for years, he renewed the applications to do the kind of surveillance, the bulk collection of telephone numbers, call records, and so forth, that's done under what's called Section 215. And that's the section that was that the court found to be illegally interpreted by the NSA. It seems very likely that when this is all done on Sunday, Section 215 will go away, and we'll go back to the way things were before the Patriot Act, which is that these records were just held by the phone companies, and they would have to respond to a specific court order. But the government couldn't collect them in bulk.
Do the cynics on the Hill and in the national security beltway culture believe that there's an easy workaround here, or does this really fundamentally change the way intelligence would be collected by the U.S. government?
You know, there's a dirty little secret to this, John, which is that the NSA didn't particularly care for Section 215, the bulk collection of this data, even before Snowden. Why? Because it was wildly expensive, and when you pressed people on it, they admitted that they had gotten very few terrorism tips from it. In fact, when a commission that the president put together after the Snowden revelations came back with their report, they could find only one case in which there may have been a terrorist attack prevented because of Section 215 bulk collection, and they even had doubts about that one. And of course, in return, we were spending huge amounts of money to collect all of this data. So, you know, the NSA had a proposal afoot before Snowden to kill this program. When the president said later on, I really do need something to give up to the critics, the NSA volunteered this one as the sacrificial lamb. And in the other powers that the NSA has for collecting abroad, almost nothing has changed and probably won't change after Congress acts.
David Sanger, national security correspondent for our partner, the New York Times. Thanks so much, David.
Thank you, John.
That's John Hockenberry at our partner program, The Takeaway.
Earlier this year, we met Jason Odner, a Phoenix nurse who was on his way to West Africa to help treat Ebola patients.
They're asking for help, and they're making the international community to step up, and so it's time for us to do that.
Odner is back home now, so we thought we'd check in with him to find out what his time abroad was like. Hi, Jason.
Thank you for having me.
So when did you get back?
I came back on the 6th.
And for how long were you in West Africa?
I was there for about 3.5 months.
So what was it like compared to what you thought that it would be like before you went? I assume you had some pictures in your mind of what you might find when you got there.
Well, you know, I've done some work in Central America before, and I was expecting the health systems to be at a similar level of development. But what I found was that the challenges West Africa is facing right now is actually quite a bit more serious than what other developed countries I've worked in are. For example, we were working in a major county hospital, the only hospital in Grangetta County, and it had neither electricity nor running water.
Did they have generators?
They had generators that were able to run several hours a day. There wasn't enough fuel to run them around the clock.
So since you've been back, what have you done or had to do to make sure that, A, you weren't sick, and B, if you were, you got the treatment and didn't pass it on to someone else?
Well, I'm following all the recommendations from the County Health Department, and I Skype with them every day.
And you feel okay?
I feel great.
No symptoms or anything?
No symptoms.
What did you end up doing while you were there?
We were working in an Ebola treatment unit, but the more important work that we were doing was trying to strengthen the health systems there. The situation that happened in West Africa can only be understood as a policy failure, a failure in global policy. If we look at it as just an unfortunate epidemiological event, then it won't change anything. We have to recognize that until we help develop stronger health systems, not only in West Africa, but throughout developing countries, we're going to continue to see things like this happen.
So how do you do that?
Well, there has to be robust global investment in helping to build strong health infrastructure. And that investment has to be broadly focused. What we see with Ebola is a lot of very narrowly focused enthusiasm. You know, the global community stepped up and invested heavily in Ebola treatment units and isolation resources. And it's wonderful that that was done. But the reality is there's a lot more people dying of malaria, of typhoid, of HIV and tuberculosis than Ebola will ever kill. And so when we invest in these countries, we have to do it in a way that strengthens the infrastructure so that it can provide better care for all of these things, so that we have better trained nurses, better trained doctors, enough medicine. In short, as Paul Farmer says, the staff, the stuff, and the systems to take care of their people.
Since you were there and now that you've been back, how much do you think that we in this country, and maybe we here in the Phoenix area, really understand about what was happening in that part of the world and the causes behind it and what it was really like?
You know, I think the lessons that need to be drawn about this are the same lessons that we need to learn right here, actually. What we saw unfold in West Africa is a microcosm of what we do right here. So, for example, in this country, we'll get somebody who is admitted to the hospital with diabetic ketoacidosis, a potentially life-threatening complication of untreated diabetes. We'll spend $60,000, $80,000 on an ICU stay trying to save their life, and we'll discharge them without primary care because we're willing to invest huge amounts of money when it's become a crisis, but we won't invest in preventative medicine. And so what we do on the micro level, on the level of an individual patient here, we also do on a global health policy basis. There's a lot of enthusiasm about investing when it's already a crisis. But afterwards, you know, the global equivalent of a primary care, of making sure that these systems exist, we need to make sure that we don't get distracted and forget about that.
Do you have plans to go back?
I hope to go back. You know, I think that it's important to continue the work that we were doing in terms of long-term strengthening of health systems, training of nurses, and helping them to develop the systems that they need to stay organized and provide the kinds of patient care that they really want to give.
Jason Odener is a Valley nurse recently back from West Africa. Jason, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Coming up, don't throw away that apple core, turn it into soil. Across the country, cities are launching composting programs.
They're doing that because landfills are expensive and also because they're just better uses for a lot of this stuff.
Now Tucson has joined the composting community. Hear about the first such program in the state. That's ahead on the show. Well, it'll be sunny and very hot this weekend around the valley. Look for high temperatures tomorrow and Sunday in the range of 103 to 105. Currently, relative humidity is at 7%. It's mostly sunny and 101 degrees. In Valley traffic, accidents to watch out for: 202 westbound at 32nd Street. That one blocks the left lane, causing a pretty heavy backup for a couple of miles. Also, collisions 101 eastbound at 27th Avenue and 101 westbound just west of 64th Street. It's 217.
KJZZ is supported by Subaru Superstore Chandler, a local family-owned and operated dealership, offering a wide range of Subaru-certified pre-owned models with standard factory warranty up to 7 years or 100,000 miles. Shop Subaru.com.
When I was 4 years old, my parents, my brother, and I moved from Chicago to Phoenix and settled in the Arcadia area. That's where I spent all of my formative years, along the canal bank and among the citrus trees and irrigated green lawns. Laren Calloway is a Valley realtor who spent a couple of decades living and working in Arcadia.
After the war, there was a tremendous amount of industry that developed here, you know, that really gave rise to the need for these new single-family homes, ranch-style homes, in the area. And, you know, being in the citrus groves was a novelty. You know, people who moved here from the Midwest, from the East Coast, thought it was this sort of delightful paradise to have a swimming pool and an orange tree. It was very exotic at the time.
There have been disagreements in the past about changes, some related to the raising of smaller houses with big front yards to make room for very large houses that extend to the street. But the battle over preserving the David and Gladys Wright house, designed by Frank Lloyd Wright, has caused a lot of division among neighbors. Attorney Zach Rawling has bought the house to preserve it, but also has talked about adding elements, possibly including a museum and a cafe, that has some in the community concerned about increased traffic and noise. We're going to hear two perspectives. In a few minutes, I'll talk to a proponent. First, though, is Jim Fersini, who is opposed to the possible plan.
Arcadia is a residential neighborhood, and it's been very well preserved for the last 80-some years, and we've held off commercial development in that 80 years. And what Mr. Rawlings is proposing totally violates that principle and is intending to bring hundreds of thousands of people through the property. 120 has been the quote that he has offered. And we don't think that we need to have a tourist destination in our neighborhood.
So are the biggest concerns related to things like traffic, things like noise? Can you be more specific?
Mr. Rawlings, in his publications, have indicated that he's taking care of parking problems and noise problems, and will take care of noise problems, et cetera. But what worries most of us is that there's a spectrum of unintended consequences that comes along with bringing that many people and creating that kind of a venue in and amongst the midst of our neighborhood. And we are of a mind that there's nothing wrong with Arcadia that we need to fix by bringing in all those people and to create a tourist destination, an event venue, a museum, Frank Lloyd Wright theme park, whatever you choose to refer to it as. So there's no reason to upset the balance that we already have. Genuine Mr. Rawlings' plans may be or may not be, we don't really know. We just don't feel that it's necessary or commensurate with the nature of the neighborhood to have such an event venue put there.
Any reason to think there can be some kind of compromise on this, where the sides come together, where maybe it's more than just preserving the house but not what some people are afraid of, what you've called grandiose ideas?
We've dialogued about that very many times, and we don't see a compromise, and I'll tell you why. Once we open up the door to compromise under a private ownership and a special use permit, an individual can come back to the town council when we've turned our gaze from this property, when we've turned our focus to something else. They can come in year after year and ask for increased rights usage permits on the property. And we don't want to have to fight that battle year in and year out. It could be a project creep, so to speak, where he could ask for additional rights and benefits. And we just don't want to have to fight that battle. And there's really no reason for us to have to. We all bought with the intention that it was RE35, single-family home on 35,000 square feet.
People who don't live in the neighborhood sort of feel like they want to make the decisions for you based on the fact that this was a Frank Lloyd Wright house. As someone who's lived there for quite a while, do you find that annoying in any way?
Well, I find it, I don't find it surprising because most people view the neighborhood as an opulent neighborhood and perhaps filled with wealthy people. And as such, people aren't really concerned with the plight of those neighbors, not really realizing that each of those neighbors, no matter how they're perceived, have invested their life savings in their house. Many of us have. And we respect and cherish our purchases just as any homeowner does, no matter what the value is.
Arcadia resident Jim Fersini, an opponent of proposed modifications to the David and Gladys Wright House property. Ron Passarelli is in favor.
That building is basically an architectural embodiment of Arizona exceptionalism, in my mind. I approached it with two goals in mind. First is preserving that preserving and celebrating that house because of its exceptional nature and the history of it. And then secondly, to protect and enhance Arcadia. And this property, in my mind, will be what real estate professionals call a cultural amenity. and it will in fact add value and prestige to Arcadia. And all of Arcadia and Phoenix really ought to appreciate this magnanimous civic gift from the Rawling family for what it is. It's philanthropy in its purest form for the public good.
What about neighbors who are sort of in the middle? They are really happy the house is preserved. They want it to be preserved, but they're worried about those other things, whether it be traffic, whether it be noise, et cetera.
And, you know, those are legitimate concerns, but the problem is that they're getting out too far in front of what's actually proposed. There have been conversations going on. The scope of the vision has been changed because of it. For example, there was early discussion about using planned unit development zoning for an overlay here. And of course, that raised the hackles on the back of a lot of our members' necks. So, you know, they understood that and said, well, you know, we really don't need that because what we want to do is basically allowed in a residential district. What we need to do is apply for some special use permits.
What would the neighborhood, the general area be like without that house? I don't mean about the proposed plan by Zach Rawling, but if that house had somehow just been destroyed.
Well, it would have been a tragic loss. It would have been, you know, more of mediocrity instead of exceptionalism. And that house embodies that. I mean, you know, the vitality of Phoenix and Arizona after World War II really emphasized individual perseverance, individual rebirth, really, because so many people came here for a new life. That house embodies that. And Wright took a look at that site that his son purchased, 10 acres, and he purposely designed that house to take advantage of the opportunity for a dialogue between that house and Camelback Mountain, that house and Papago Buttes, and the surrounding citrus.
Do you think this is, because of the impact of Frank Lloyd Wright, because of the impact of the Arcadia neighborhood, is this something that the rest of the city, rest of the community should be interested in, or do you think it's been blown out of proportion to some extent?
To my mind, what will happen is what happened in Paris. When President Mitterrand hired IMP to do the restoration at the Louvre, and they announced and presented Pei's design for the new entrance, the howls went up from all of Paris. How could you? This is defiling a sacred location. Well, fortunately, those two men, the client and the architect, had a clear vision of what could be. And to quote Teresa Hines, places become what people dream. And together they dreamt something that now is accepted by all of Paris, all of France, the world. All of Phoenix and Arcadia will come to understand the value of that in our midst.
Ron Passarelli, who's in favor of proposed modifications to the David and Gladys Wright House property in Arcadia. Across the country, food is being thrown away constantly, about a half pound per person per day. The EPA estimates that food waste makes up nearly a quarter of landfill space. KJZZ's Stina Sieg introduces us to a new citywide composting program in Tucson, the first in the state.
The basic idea of composting sounds great. Food scraps and yard waste decomposing into usable, nutrient-rich soil. But sometimes the process can be a little more like
a pile in the corner that sometimes was doing okay and sometimes had a lot of flies and sometimes didn't smell very good.
That was Kelly Kreiner's experience with home composting. The general manager of Tucson's Food Conspiracy Co-op says she still hasn't perfected the art. And neither did the co-op. Despite best intentions, Kreiner says a lack of manpower always kept the store's past composting attempts small and less successful than she would have hoped.
But it's really great now to just have the truck pull up and, you know, with its little automated arm.
That's because Food Conspiracy is one of about 50 Tucson businesses participating in the Food Scraps Collection Program. Compostable food gets picked up twice a week by the city, just like recycling or trash. Except those pieces of pita bread and organic coffee grounds end up here. At the San Javier Co-op Farm south of town. That sound you hear is a machine that kind of looks like a tractor that turns and waters rows upon rows of dark, composted soil. Compost Cats is the composting program run by the University of Arizona. It was born 4 years ago and is now run as a partnership with the city. Chet Phillips is a sustainability coordinator at the university. He says last year, it helped keep 3 million pounds of food out of the local landfill.
We expect to be somewhere between 5 and 6 million pounds in 2015, and I'm guessing we're going to continue to grow for several years after that.
Compost Cats is self-sustaining, with fees for pickup service and compost sales making more than its $80,000 annual budget. While this is a new thing for Arizona, Philip says composting is a trend all over the country. New York City recently began a program. San Francisco requires residents to compost.
They're doing that because landfills are expensive and also because they're just better uses for a lot of this stuff.
Like creating the kind of soil that doesn't come naturally in the arid Southwest.
Compost adds water holding capacity to the soil and it adds nutrients. We need all of that that we can get.
So it's good for gardens and it's good for the environment. But it's also good for businesses' bottom lines. For many, it costs the same or less to compost as it would to throw away all their food waste. Now, several restaurants and grocery stores are getting on board that may never have if it wasn't this easy and economical. Like Hotel Congress and Maynard's Market, where Todd Hanley is the manager.
I'm not an activist by any stretch.
But he believes his industry is going to have to go in this direction. Otherwise, he says, it will simply be wasting a resource that could be used for good.
Trash is inevitable. We just, unfortunately, that's just what comes out of the type of, you know, world we live in. But to minimize the trash, and then more than anything, take advantage of what is considered to be trash in a positive way, I guess it's just hard for me to fathom why you wouldn't do it.
It's a no-brainer, Hanley says, and imagines that pretty soon, even more businesses will see it that way, too. Stina Sieg, KJZZ News, reporting from Tucson.
This season's NBA Finals matchup is set, and the Phoenix Suns are nowhere near that battle. The organization has missed the playoffs for five straight seasons, but a lot of people who made major decisions for the Suns now work for the Cleveland Cavaliers and Golden State Warriors. Those include Golden State head coach Steve Kerr and his top assistant Alvin Gentry, and Cleveland general manager David Griffin. ESPN NBA front office insider Amin El-Hassan is with us to talk about that. Amin, Steve Kerr took over Golden State from Mark Jackson, took the team to the finals in his first season. What do you see about his coaching style that's reminiscent of how he ran the Suns front office?
What Coach Kerr did was he kind of released the shackles on the offense. He brought a lot more creativity, freedom, but also a management style that I think is very inclusive, and this is something I speak about from experience, because I know what it's like to work for him. I know how those guys now feel playing for him. He's very much a rule by committee kind of guy. He's not an iron-fisted dictator or anything. And I think for this team, this was the kind of voice they needed to take them to the next level.
When we look at the two organizations that are in the finals, there are so many Suns ties here. Did the Suns, you know, really mess up by having a lot of these guys either leave of their own accord or get sort of kicked out the door?
Yes and no. I think when you look at the way Steve Kerr and David Griffin left, that was a mishandled situation. Alvin Gentry getting let go, despite everyone knowing that team wasn't a good team, that no one could have won with that roster, was also disappointing. And I think they do bear some responsibility. I mean, it's not just those three individuals. You've got assistant coach Jaren Collins, who's a former player here with the Suns. Leandro Barbosa, playing for the Suns, is now playing for the Warriors. Roger Bell is the director of player development with the Cavaliers. He was obviously one of the most beloved Suns while he was here. Sean Marion. There are a lot of familiar names and faces. And in some of those cases, that's just time, and players move on, coaches move on, et cetera. But when you talk about this organization was run by two of the brighter guys in the NBA, in David Griffin and Steve Kerr, and they felt unappreciated enough to move on, I think that really does lie with the organization, that this is something that they had and they blew it.
When I think of those three guys, and you mentioned other people, but Gentry, Kerr, and Griffin, they all seem to have a good rapport with the media. They all seem to be very pleasant, friendly people. How much does that help in terms of putting a good face on an organization?
They were good people. They had great people skills. You know, Steve Kerr has an incredible ability to relate to people on so many different levels. He has got a long, illustrious NBA career where he won 5 championships. So he's, and alongside some of the greatest players of all time, so he's able to relate to role players, to superstars, to international players, to domestic players. All 3 of these guys have these great people skills, and it helps, obviously, when dealing with the media, but it helps in everything else. It helps when dealing with players. It helps when dealing with agents. It helps with dealing with the people on your staff, and that's what makes them all great leaders in their own right.
ESPN NBA front office insider Amin El Hassan. Good afternoon. You're listening to the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein. Coming up, we'll hear about the ripple effect of the drought on Arizona. Currently mostly sunny skies and 101 degrees at 2:34.
KJZZ is supported by the Phoenix Symphony, presenting a stirring production of Oliver, performed by Phoenix Theater alongside the Symphony at Symphony Hall, May 29th through 31st. Info at phoenixsymphony.org.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Louise Schiavone. The New York Times, the LA Times, and NBC News are reporting that former Speaker of the House Dennis Hastert was paying a man not to say publicly that Hastert had sexually abused him decades ago. NPR has not yet confirmed the reports independently. The Illinois Republican was once second in line to the presidency as Speaker of the House from 1999 to 2007. He is charged with lying to the FBI about huge cash bank withdrawals between 2010 and 2014. He is free on his own recognizance. Americans are feeling slightly better about the economy than they were earlier in May. Steve Beckner of Market News International has more.
Consumer spending accounts for 2/3 of gross domestic product, and as the first quarter GDP report confirmed, it has been sluggish. One reason may be a lack of confidence in the economy and its outlook. In its final reading for May, the University of Michigan's closely watched Index of Consumer Sentiment rose more than 2 points from a preliminary report to 90.7, but that is still more than 5 points lower than in April. Among households surveyed, assessments of current economic conditions and expectations are down. The survey suggests Americans are inclined to be cautious about spending. For NPR News, I'm Steve Beckner.
President Obama is warning that unless the Senate acts this weekend, surveillance powers used by the NSA to prevent attacks could lapse at midnight Sunday.
I don't want us to be in a situation in which, for a certain period of time, those authorities go away and suddenly we're dark, and heaven forbid, we've got a problem.
The Senate returns to session on Sunday. Wall Street, the Dow closed down 115 points. The NASDAQ fell 27. This is NPR.
As California grapples with water shortages, Arizonans can breathe easy, for now. For decades, the state has relied on the Colorado River and preserved groundwater resources. But this drought is now putting those management plans to the test. KJZZ's Will Stone reports.
It's spring, and the wheat is ripening on Ron Rayner's farm just west of Phoenix.
When you bite that little kernel and it cracks, you know it's very dry and brittle.
The neighborhood has changed since Rayner began growing in the 60s. Airplanes and industrial developments now occupy old farmland. But business is still good. If anything, Arizona growers who have access to reliable water are seeing increased demand and high prices. Rayner, who uses groundwater, says his well is delivering the same amount as 30 years ago.
Our water use today is not significantly different. But when I look at what we're producing from it, we've essentially doubled our production since the 1980 Groundwater Management Act.
That's when the state, responding to rapidly declining aquifers, began regulating groundwater in much of central Arizona, setting limits on how much growers can pump, halting new farmland, and requiring municipal providers to replenish what they use. All this to reach what's called safe yield in places like Phoenix and Tucson by 2025, meaning a balance between how much water is pumped and recharged. But
in none of those areas will we reach that goal.
Karen Smith is a fellow at the Grand Canyon Institute and former deputy director of the State Department of Water Resources. She says we're not in balance now, and That's troubling. As climate change progresses, less water comes from rivers and snowpack, and the drought deepens, more people will turn to groundwater.
Arizona's situation is going to worsen. So with all of those variables, to begin that change already in a hole makes that hole get deeper.
According to the most recent state numbers, the Phoenix area could be out of balance by 400,000 acre feet in a high growth scenario. Tucson is less, just about a quarter of that. Pinal County, a hub of agriculture, is also in overdraft. This drought could only exacerbate the problem. Thomas Bishotsky is director of the Department of Water Resources. He says Arizona is not in a crisis.
We have the ability to backfill our water supplies when these shortages hit at the Tier 1, 2, and 3 level. We're pretty resilient.
Each tier represents a greater cutback in Arizona's share of the Colorado River. Current projections show a Tier 1 shortage, the least severe, being declared in 2017. None of this will immediately impact cities, but farmers will lose half, if not more, of their water. And many will likely return to what they once used, groundwater.
We will probably see, depending on how much they pump and where, some impacts to the aquifers. But again, that's their legal right, and that was part of the compromise that created the groundwater code in the first place.
In other words, those farmers who lose Colorado water still have the right to pump and no obligation to replenish that water. How much could groundwater use increase? The state has no estimates yet. If all the farmers who have water rights start pumping, that could have major unanticipated impacts.
That would be a gross overestimation of how much they're actually going to pump, kind of a worst-case scenario.
When you don't worry about the nightmare scenario, you're not at all ready when the nightmare scenario occurs.
That's Karen Smith again. While the state has banked almost 9 million acre feet for drought, Smith says farmers are licensed to pump 5 million acre feet, which isn't factored into any water use projections.
It is a dark prospect. I think they simply don't want to acknowledge that.
To be clear, Arizona has done better than other states planning for drought. Chuck Cullum is with the Central Arizona Project, which provides Colorado River water. He says they already have many conservation and efficiency programs, ample reservoir storage capacity, and the potential to treat poor quality water in the future.
Our solution is not to go back on an unsustainable groundwater situation.
This is the message of water managers throughout the state. We're prepared. But ultimately, no one knows how much rain or snow will come next winter. Then there's the larger existential threat. Southwest states are promised an unrealistic amount of the Colorado River in the first place. Just one more question in what could be a very dry future. Will Stone, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
California's four-year drought has raised a number of questions about water scarcity and the capacity for agriculture in the Southwest. But many people are also concerned about what role the drought will play economically. Joining me now is KJZZ's Sarah Ventry. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Steve. The idea that there could be a long-term ripple effect of the drought got us thinking about whether it might have a direct effect on consumers. So I brought this up to George Friswald. He's a professor of agricultural and resource economics at the U of A. I asked him how all of this could affect food prices, given the high cost of water for farmers.
There's lots of things that affect our overall food prices. You know, we live in a global economy, and so through trade, if there's a production hiccup in one part of the world, other people pick up the slack. The thing to understand for an average consumer is that for every dollar you spend at the checkout counter on food, farmers only get 12 cents out of that dollar. The rest is in transport and labor and energy and packaging. So that means a really big increase in prices at the farm gate translates into a much smaller increase at the checkout counter.
Obviously, there's long-term concern about the amount of water needed to sustain agriculture and even just people who live in the Southwest. Are there other long-term ripple effects of this drought?
I think what's different now, it isn't just California. It's really, really pervasive. You've got drought conditions throughout the Southwest. So as the drought persists, there's going to be more, you know, cases, and there's going to be more news stories of wells running dry and people having to adjust to that. I know in California, in some communities in the Central Valley where there's folks who just rely on well water, and what happens if your only source of water is well water and it runs dry? Now, most people aren't in that situation. You know, most of us, we turn on a tap and something's coming from a public utility. And a lot of the urban utilities have been doing a lot of drought planning. All the major, like, urban water utilities do all kinds of scenario analysis. So you're going to have isolated cases where people, especially in poorer communities, people who don't have infrastructure, are going to be more vulnerable. We in the cities are kind of spoiled because, for the most part, we're going to turn on the tap and the water's going to come out. We're going to go to the grocery store and prices aren't going to change all that much. Whereas out on the farms, they're not having water delivered and the prices they're paying are shooting way, way up.
I kind of want to talk about what you just mentioned about the utility companies and about this idea that there's been planning in the works for some time and there are different scenarios that are kind of constantly being run. What is the plan and who's doing the planning?
The Arizona Department of Water Resources has been doing planning. Central Arizona Project, all the urban water utilities, Salt River Project, they all have been looking and monitoring at drought conditions and water conditions, and they have various contingency plans for what to do. And Arizona, compared to California, is in somewhat better shape. You know, we've had a Groundwater Management Act in place, and we've been taking, you know, surface water from the Colorado River and putting it in our aquifers, so we've been banking that somewhat. California has just enacted groundwater legislation. Arizona started out with very scarce water, so we put institutions in place accounting for that. And so in that respect, I think, you know, we're better off in California, who's having to play catch-up really fast.
George Friswald is a professor of agricultural and resource economics at the U of A.
KJZZ's Sarah Ventry. Sarah, thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. Get ready for a very hot weekend around the valley. Looking for sunny skies both Saturday and Sunday, and highs between 103 and 105. Currently, it's mostly sunny and 101 degrees. Checking valley traffic, an accident 202 eastbound at 32nd Street, a major trouble spot. At least two lanes are blocked. Again, the 202 eastbound at 32nd Street. There's also a collision 101 westbound at 27th Avenue, which has blocked the off-ramp. It's 245.
KJZZ is supported by AJ's Fine Foods, announcing their seafood extravaganza with a selection of fresh seafood and shellfish flown in daily. 10 Valley locations can be found at ajsfinefoods.com.
"111 degrees? Phoenix can't really be that hot, can it? Oh my God, it's like standing on the sun!
This city should not exist. It is a monument to man's arrogance."
Obviously, there are many challenges living in a desert. As concerns about water shortages and energy consumption are multiplied by the impending summer heat, it may leave you wondering what we're doing here, or perhaps even should Phoenix exist at all? NYU history professor Andrew Needham will address that question as part of a panel discussion at the Heard Museum next week. But Andrew, what are your thoughts on this question even being brought up?
Well, I think the question is fascinating that it gets asked of Phoenix and seemingly no other city. There's a long line of environmental writing about Phoenix that essentially says that this city is, if people are being charitable, a kind of, you know, misguided folly. When they're not being charitable, they call it things like an abomination or, as Ed Abbey called it, the blob that ate Arizona. And, you know, I think in part that language exists as the, you know, the counterpoint to a certain kind of, you know, booster rhetoric that's always been part of Phoenix. I mean, the city's name is, after all, Phoenix. So I think one of the things going on in this kind of environmental critique is, you know, a certain sense that Phoenix is somehow an artificial imposition, you know, upon nature. And, you know, of course, building a city in the desert. I mean, Phoenix has the highest summer temperatures of any city in North America. You know, this reflects a certain kind of hubris. And it's also a city built almost entirely since World War II. You know, the population of Phoenix was 100,000, you know, about when the war ended, and now, what, 4 million? So that's a really dramatic change over 70 years that I think leads people to ask, you know, was this a good thing? Should this city continue to exist? And when looking at the desert, people think, well, can this continue to exist?
Do you think that Phoenix is subject to more criticism than some other places, especially considering a place that has grown so much? Certainly Detroit gets criticized, but people that have left Detroit, whereas they tend to have come to Phoenix, and yet it's a place that, well, you know, I would never go there until perhaps I see the Super Bowl and it's 70 degrees in February, then maybe I will come.
Right. No, the boosters of Phoenix in the 50s and 60s were very astute about inviting newspaper reporters out to report on the growth of Phoenix in February.
Right.
And I think that Detroit and Phoenix are an interesting, you know, pairing, both of those cities, because they are the extreme example on the one hand of growth and the extreme example on the other hand of deindustrialization. You serve as these kind of convenient punching bags, and, you know, oftentimes I think allow critics to, you know, ignore some of the similar, you know, patterns they're critiquing in Phoenix that are going on, you know, near their own home.
When a city grows as fast as Phoenix did, there are obvious pitfalls along the way. Do you think those pitfalls were thought about enough, or was it sort of just this big growth and the idea was, okay, once the federal government approved the Central Arizona Project and once air conditioning was a thing that we could all get, and even swimming pools in the backyard, it became, well, maybe those pitfalls are less important because we've found a way to sort of counteract them?
I mean, I think that the assumption that kind of resources would become available and resources would be found was really, part of the ethos of growth, that kind of any environmental limits were things that could be fairly easily surmounted, and that the city itself was a source of such economic growth that solutions would be found. And this is an idea promoted not only within Phoenix. This is one of the things, you know, federal agencies come to promote as well. I mean, there's a reason that the Bureau of Reclamation is very much in favor of the Central Arizona Project for a long time. You know, so the way that the ethos of metropolitan growth works in post-war America, it certainly comes from boosters in Phoenix, but it also comes from, you know, officials at a variety of levels of the American government.
Based on what you have researched, based on what you know about Phoenix, is this a place that could be a leader, a pioneer in dealing with some of these issues, or could the critics be right that ends up, you know, sending Phoenix down into a place where the growth stops and maybe it starts to shrink a little bit?
Well, I think the cities of the, you know, in the Southwest today, because of the, you know, because of the way that kind of water is allocated, because of, you know, the ongoing drought, are going to become increasingly places of, you know, experimentation. Now, experimentation may mean that, you know, that costs go up. You know, obviously a lot of Phoenix's growth has long rested on, you know, the idea that as early as 1950, they're saying, well, you get more housing. Your housing dollar goes farther in Phoenix than anywhere else in the country. It may be that kind of environmental constraints, that climate change, drought, all of these things, you know, end up creating new costs that make, you know, Phoenix's growth less explosive.
Andrew Needham is associate professor of history at New York University, and he's also the author of Power Lines: Phoenix and the Making of the Modern Southwest. He'll be in the Valley next Wednesday as part of a panel talking about should Phoenix exist. Andrew, thank you for the time.
Thanks, Steve.
The Valley is home to several airports that date back to World War II. One that's still in service today is among the best of its kind in the country. KJZZ's Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez takes us there.
Just off the Red Mountain Freeway Loop 202, near Greenfield Road, is Falcon Field. The North Mesa Airport was an aviation training facility during World War II. Did you know Falcon Field was a U.S. military airfield developed to train Allied forces?
This particular field was selected to train British Royal Air Force pilots.
Sitting under a Ramada as planes fly over us, Falcon Field Director Corrine Nystrom tells me about the facility.
There were a few thousand that were trained here. Yeah, 2,000 to 3,000.
He was a famous trumpet man from our Chicago way.
Before the U.S. became involved in World War II in 1941, it committed to supporting Allied forces. Falcon Field was among a handful of aviation training facilities across the U.S. that opened to help prepare military airmen.
This area here going down to McKellips Road was pretty much all of it. None of these buildings that we see in other parts of the airport, none of that was here. That was just still flat, dry desert.
Falcon Field was a 500-acre facility. There were two Quonset hut-style hangars, a control tower, and two runways. The offices, sleeping quarters, and the officers' club were in a square-shaped campus south of the tower. Nystrom says many believe the name Falcon Field came from the aviators themselves, wanting a predatory bird as a symbol for their training and abilities.
Mesa wasn't as big as it is now, and so it was a pretty good drive to get from Mesa out here, which they probably did that intentionally so that the cadets could really focus on their training.
Ah, and there was a pool in the middle of the campus.
The story is that as soon as a pilot got his wings to fly, then one of the ways that they would indoctrinate them into Welcome to the Pilot Club would be to throw them in the pool.
Attention, the peoples of the world. World War II is about to come to its official closing. We're on the Pacific Fleet flagship USS Missouri.
When the war ended, the government decided it no longer needed Falcon Field and sold it to the city of Mesa for a dollar, with the condition it would remain an airport. Today, the swimming pool is gone, and the only remaining relics of wartime are the two hangars and the fireplace from inside the officers' club. Falcon Field is one of the busiest general aviation airports in the U.S. It's home to one of the largest pilot training agencies in the world, a World War II museum, and the Mesa Police Aviation Unit. It's also the home of the Falcon Warbirds. Those warbirds perform missing man flyovers at valley cemeteries. It's the show. I'm Nadine Arroyo Rodriguez.
If you've got ideas or hear things that make Phoenix unique, send us a note, theshow@kjzz.org. Be careful if you're driving around downtown Phoenix over the next couple of days. Superheroes, anime characters, and zombies may be crossing the street heading for Phoenix Comic-Con. Tom Kuypers is the press and media coordinator.
You know, I think one of the things that people are looking for is kind of a contrast to what San Diego does, let's say. Theirs is a lot about, you know, new stuff, kind of trying to get attention for new movies and things like that. Whereas I think ours is more of just sort of a celebration of this stuff. Like, yeah, we have actors and people promoting things here, but it's really just a great time with just amazing artists and things like that where we're just sort of celebrating this stuff. I think that's kind of what sets us apart from a lot of other conventions.
Is this a place where people feel like they can be themselves? As you mentioned, there's more acceptance, I guess, in general. But
yeah,
when it comes to cosplay, when it comes to people who are just really dressed and ready to go and fired up. And what's interesting to me, too, is that, again, there must be a comfort zone there. You don't feel like you're going to get ridiculed. People have sort of that common sense.
Yeah. And, you know, one of our slogan this year, I guess, is just come discover your inner geek. It's a safe place for people to express themselves. You know, it gives people who are really passionate or really interested in a topic, it gives them a place where they can kind of go all out and meet with people who are similarly passionate and similarly interested in different things.
I'm sure you're excited about everything, but are there a few highlights you can tell us about for this weekend?
The thing that I'm most excited about is one of my favorite movies is Back to the Future, and we have Christopher Lloyd here, and we have a DeLorean as well. And he's taking pictures with him, and I'm really excited about that because that's going to be awesome.
You know, actually, the DeLorean brings up an interesting point, too, because with some of these some of these things, I mean, the Batmobile, for example, are there a lot of vehicles? Is there sort of a thing set aside for like things like that, whether spaceships or cars or whatnot?
So this year, what's interesting is we have the whole convention center. In the past, we've kind of had only parts of it. And what that's allowed us to do is we actually block off the whole the street in between the, I think it's 3rd Street, in between the two buildings. You know, we have the Ghostbusters, we have Ecto-1, and we have the different Batmobiles, and there's some G.I. Joe-themed Jeeps around, too, and there's all sorts of vehicles and things like that around.
Are you seeing this in a broader sense? And I mean, with Comic-Con in general, but even as far as our society is concerned, that people are just a lot more interested in, I'm going to call it fantasy or sci-fi or whatnot.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's kind of a joke that I think Hollywood ran out of ideas to a certain extent, and then they came to us for ideas, and you know, they've been making comic book movies and things like that. Because I mean, there's probably half a dozen TV shows and half a dozen movies that you wouldn't even expect were inspired by comic books and things like that. But there's certainly people like Steve Jobs, right? It made being smart and being unique and interesting, it made it cool. It's like nerd is sort of the new cool in a weird way, right? Like it's not as, there's not as much of a stigma to it.
Tom, finally, if you were to let your inner geek go, what would you dress as?
I would, you know, I'm a big Green Lantern fan. I would probably dress up like Green Lantern.
Tom, thanks so much for the time.
Absolutely. Yeah, thanks for having
me. Well, there's a lot going on this weekend, as you just heard. If you're into comics, fantasy, that kind of thing, you've got the Phoenix Comic Con. Also, if you like tribute bands and David Lee Roth scares you a little bit, you might want to try Van Halen. That's tonight and tomorrow night at 7:30 at Casino Arizona at Salt River in Scottsdale. Also, the Rhythm Edition is performing at Fort McDowell Casino tonight and tomorrow night at 9. Phoenix Symphony presents Oliver. That's tonight and tomorrow at 7:30 p.m., also Sunday at 4. And you can learn to curl, but you have to get up a little bit early for it. Tomorrow morning at 9, the Coyotes Curling Club in Tempe. Today's show was produced by our senior producers, Sarah Ventry and Jimmy Jenkins, with help from Bruce Drummond, Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez, Tiara Vian, and Annika Klein. Tracy Greer, Sky Shatter, and Maria Springs are the digital team. Our news director is Al Macias. The executive producer is John, the venerated one, Hoban. We want to hear from you. Let us know what you think. Let us know about good story ideas. We're at the show at kjzz.org. With Mark Brody, I'm Steve Goldstein. All Things Considered is next on member-supported KJZZ FM Phoenix in HD at 3 o'clock.